Today, we have another very special international guest on our show. Dr. Vivian Ming is a theoretical neuroscientist. She's one of the world's leading experts in the field of AI, and she's also the co-founder of Sorcos Labs, which is the fifth company that she founded and a think tank exploring the future of human potential. Vivian is also a person with an incredible story in her life that she's sharing in this episode, and she's really opening up and talking about what it means to be a high flyer in her teens with so many options in her life, but hating herself at the same time and really suffering under those expectations, becoming a homeless as a result, then changing her perception on life and becoming successful on the outside, however still not happy with herself, then going through gender transition, becoming a very successful entrepreneur and scientist afterwards. And she's sharing all of that, and she's also talking about her experiences of how she was treated as a man before transition, how differently she was treated afterwards. We're talking about the tax on being different, opportunities missed as a result for our society, and we're talking about hiring bias, which doubles the likelihood of going out of business according to Vivian's research. We're talking about biases in AI. We're talking about the current COVID-19 crisis and her view on it, and also what technologies can help to solve the crisis. I must say that I always love the conversations with her because she's got so many valuable insights and takeaways that she shares, and I'm sure that you will also get a lot out of this.
Hi, ich bin Jonathan Sierk und willkommen bei den Gesprächen von morgen.
Welcome to our show, Vivian. As always, I'm very much looking forward to the conversation with you.
It will be a lot of fun. I'm always have fun talking with you.
So far, we've mostly discussed topics around AI and the future of learning. That's also how we met at the conference at Singularity University. I'm still thinking back to that fondly. And today, I want to emphasize a few other topics and focus more on your recent work. Talk about diversity, the tax of being different. I think that's what you call it. Maybe we can touch upon biases in AI. And I would also be very interested in your take on the current COVID-19 crisis. And I would like to start out with a personal quote that I read in one of your recent papers that helps also to introduce you a bit at the same time. And in that quote, you were saying that you founded obviously a few companies and served on several boards all since your transitioning that I want to touch upon just now. And you're saying in that paper that that simple fact tells every little kid who feels different that their hard work truly can pay off. And you're also saying that you're proud to be a trans woman in a position of leadership, and even more so that you're not the only one. And you're particularly proud to have been elected this year to be the chair of Startout, the nonprofit dedicated organization to increase the number, diversity and impact of LGBT entrepreneurs. And with your research and your advocacy, Startout is helping a whole new generation of leaders to realize their full potential. And you're saying that there was no one like you growing up, but for kids today, that will never be true again. And I would like to ask you to maybe share your personal story a bit, because when we will talk about diversity, I think it will be great for all the listeners to hear how much you've been affected by all of this.
Sure, I'd be happy to. So I guess to the degree that people know of me, at least in the technology world, it's from my work as a theoretical neuroscientist, where we use machine learning to study the brain at UC Berkeley, or my education technology companies. I've built companies using AI in hiring. And what I guess is a point of pride to me is that all of this has been in the latter half of my life. That it is as Vivian, that I have gone out and I've published these papers and I have founded these companies. I've invented technologies to save people's lives and invented companies to create jobs. And it's worth noting that, my life hasn't always been this way. Mm-hmm. I mean, and there's all sorts of layers of meaning to that. And the funny thing is, if you looked when I was a little kid, you maybe would have thought, well, gosh, is that all you've done? When I was little, I was supposed to win a Nobel Prize. I was supposed to be this amazing person to transform the world. And yet the more I tried to be that person, for my parents, for my school, for myself, the more everything got worse. Mm-hmm. And everything I was trying to achieve in life, it just seemed to get farther away the more I tried to achieve it. What a horrible paradox for a little kid. And not that you should shed some ridiculous tear for me. I had a pretty good life, and I could have made something of it, and I didn't, and it all fell apart. I ended up failing out of university and being homeless, and I just couldn't figure out why it was I was not the person that I was supposed to be. And, you know, for me, those years were this incredible lesson, a really brutal lesson, I will be honest, a lesson about that life isn't about me. Life isn't about whether I'm happy, or at least to the degree that it was, none of that worked. The more that it was about me being happy, the less happy I became. So I made a very big choice, which was somewhat bluntly to keep living. You know, you can't look at yourself, being homeless and think, boy, I'm doing everything right and I should really keep at this. And so, you know, it was in my mind that it is time to give up. There was a point, in the 90s where I was literally crossing off days on a calendar, waiting for the end. And instead, I came to this decision that I should stop being so worried about what anyone thought about me, including myself. And I should just do the things that I believed would be good for others. And as I often have said in other interviews, that probably sounds very philosophical or very self-congratulatory. I just needed a reason to be alive. It's as blunt and simple as that. And suddenly, once I made those decisions and worked really hard to climb back out of the hole I had dug for myself, everything was so easy. School was so easy. I finished my whole undergraduate degree in a single year. I had these amazing marks in school. I got to go to whatever PhD program I wanted to and worked on whatever I wanted to. And I still hated myself. Nothing I did was truly satisfying. But the difference between those moments and the moments earlier in my life was that it wasn't about me. It didn't matter if I hated myself. What mattered is that what I was doing was making a difference. And so I kept going. And I actually met someone I fell in love with, and I was this hot shot coming out of grad school with my choice of where to be professor. And that's when I realized, the funny thing is, I guess it wasn't a hard choice at that point. The hard choice was admitting I was never going to be the person that I thought I was when I was little. The hard choice was giving up on all of this identity around success and accomplishment and the idea I'd be this exceptional person. And the funny thing is, then I started to find those things. Mm-hmm. And it was in the midst of that that I, one day, it was my birthday in 2005, and I turned to my then fiance and I said, "You want to know my deep, dark secret?" I said, "I wish I was a woman." And I said, "Well, good night," and rolled over to go back to bed. Needless to say, neither of us slept that night. And, you know, the funny thing is, my life was good. It was good in a way it had never been before. I didn't go through gender transition because it was that or nothing. I went through it because I could see that that was the next step to me being a better person. I was beginning to have this success in life. I had someone that made me happy, but I didn't make me happy. And it took a few years to go through this process, but I became me. And the irony is I lost my position at Stanford. The head of the institute there said, you've lost your edge. However, in the year since then, I've founded 5 companies. I've been the chief scientist at 2 others. I've literally made world-altering discoveries. I'm a different person, no doubt. But I just have a different edge than I had before. Happens to be a happy one. So I guess the whole process of this story is one of realizing that if I really wanted to do something meaningful with my life, if I wanted to find happiness or win a prize or make some great discovery, the great paradox of my personal life is the only way to do it is to give up on all of those things and just do the thing you think is right. And some of those things seem crazy, like giving up on the privilege of being a man. Let me tell you, the world does not treat women terribly well. And yet all of these were the right steps. Every one of them, every time I made these crazy, irrational decisions because I thought it was right rather than I thought it would make me happy, my life got better every single time. And so, yes, when I look at all the companies, all of the inventions, the scientific work, I don't believe any of it would have happened had I still been that other person. They happened because I was me. And I would like to believe the world is better because I'm me. I guess part of what I do in my work in inclusion is make the pitch that there's a really selfish argument to be accepting of other people. Your life is better when other people truly get to be themselves. And I hope my personal life is a tribute to that. And yeah, you know, the idea, and I'm sure this is as true in Europe as it is in America, when I was a little kid in the 70s and in the 80s, the idea of transgender people, they were the best portrayal was like a punchline in a joke. You know, it was the football player at a school reunion that is, you know, now a stripper. And yet what I hope is I've shown people, and yes, maybe some people thinking about their identity themselves, that they can be so much more than that, that they could be a scientist, that they could found a company, that they could make the world better and do more than cabaret acts. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but everybody is so much more, whether we're talking about gender transition or just gender in general or race or disability. You know, the only, well, it's not the only, we don't just do harm to the people whom we discriminate against. We do harm to ourselves. All of the amazing things they could have done, all of the people they could have been, we collectively take away, and therefore we take it away from ourselves. And I think a lot of my research in this space has been to look at just how irrational that is.
And I guess that's also why you're saying that the most important thing to understand about the tax on being different is that we all pay it. But I want to discuss that in more depth. Thank you so much for opening up, Vivian, and sharing that story. And I guess that the listeners will have a couple of questions and things to discuss about the points that you've made. I mean, you shared so many valuable takeaways already. And I guess, like, to ask one more personal question that I found very, very inspiring when I heard your story for the first time was the reaction of your fiance and that you have 2 beautiful children now and that you're still together. And maybe you can share 1 or 2 sentences on how your partner reacted during that time and also how your environment reacted. I mean, you shared the story of the head of Stanford, how he reacted, and you were also commenting during one of the speeches I heard from you that fundraising all of a sudden became much harder for you when you were a woman. Maybe start out by sharing a few thoughts on how your fiance reacted, how your environment, your friends, everyone else reacted.
Sure. Let's be crystal clear. It's not like this wasn't a challenging process to go through. Yeah. And I should correct one thing right away. The head of Stanford, John, is a great guy. I've had many conversations with him. This was the head of a particular institute I was at Stanford.
Okay.
And he had his beliefs about the world. He just happens to be wrong. It's as simple as that. The amazing thing is I turned to my then fiance. I said what I said, my deep, dark secret. I wish I was a woman. And, her reaction in the moment was basically, tell me more. She had been a teacher earlier in her life and she'd had counselor training, and she just immediately switched into put her counselor hat on, and we stayed up all night talking. But I think the thing that really captures it is later, we were being interviewed of all things, this famous interviewer, in the United States, Oprah's best friend. And she said, to my wife, Norma, clearly, things changed. Why did you stay together? You fell in love with a completely different person. And Norma responded that the person I loved was deeply unhappy, and I knew it. And now she's happy, and I love her even more. And I had never heard her say that. I heard her in some of those moments share things that I didn't know, like the fact that she was scared. She had never let me know that she was scared going through this process. Not scared in the sense that maybe many listeners might think, but scared in the sense that, what if I change so much that I leave?
Yeah.
What if we're not sort of in a sense compatible anymore? But here's the thing. The reason I never knew she was scared is because she was a rock for me. I needed her support, and she gave me total support. She went to her sisters and got her support from them. She recognized that both things were important, and she made it happen without going back, to the person that's going through the hardest part of this and saying, not only do you have to go through transition, but you also have to support everyone else in your life that doesn't fully understand why. That happens. But I guess I do have the chance to talk to a lot of parents and say, listen, if you love and you trust your child, then trust that they're making a good decision, and that your job now is to make what comes next in their life as much of a celebration as possible. Because I hope my life is proof that this can be and is a celebration. It's not like many people are going to go through this. It is hard. It is physically hard. It turns out not a lot of, Stanford educated venture capitalists are particularly interested in giving millions and millions of dollars to some transgender woman with a kooky idea about how to transform education. And so my first time launching a company and raising money, here is the truly amazing thing. Most of them did not know that I had gone through transition. So I've gone back in the years since and chatted with them all of the hardship, and it was hard. And it was not my first time ever raising money. So I'd had the experience of doing this as a man. And I'm not saying it's easy, but it happened. And then the next time through, that first time, I had no degrees. I had flunked out of school. I had the business plan was non-existent, all of it. And yet we put the money together. My first tech company, I had a couple of PhDs. I had amazing technology that we could demo for people that they actually liked. I had what I can say in retrospect as a serial successful entrepreneur was actually a good business plan, and nobody wanted to fund us. And invariably, it was because they didn't want to fund me. They didn't want to fund some blonde woman that had never done a business before. They just assumed I didn't know how to run a business. And fair enough that I didn't, but here's the secret for everyone. Nobody does. Everybody's just making up a bunch of nonsense and doing the best they can. And there's an incredibly steep learning curve on that first startup. And you just do the best that you can and learn as fast as you possibly can. I often joke that my first tech company was an education company, but purely an education for me. It was nothing but learning the whole time. Mm. But getting money out of those venture capitalists was brutal. And it really boiled down to experiences like one VC saying, this is the amazing technology. I can't believe you can read students' minds. We couldn't, but that was as much as they understood machine learning back then. And I'll give you $2 million if you do financial fraud detection and I get to pick the CEO. So I'm literally sitting across the table and he is saying I can take his money if he can fire me. And another experience, a VC voted against funding us literally in the same afternoon at which he patted me on the head like I was a little child. You know, it really is astonishing how dismissive the venture capital is of women. And I can say this with some real authority because I've experienced it both ways.
And I mean, you also said that you've raised venture capital for so many companies and you've never been, there has never been a female VC to hear a single one of those pitches, which I also find quite hard to believe.
Where I have been a sole or a co-founder, the times I've been a chief scientist, and I now sit on the boards of a bunch of companies. And I certainly know some female VCs. They exist. They are increasing in numbers and becoming more prominent. But you know, back in the history, I don't have to raise money anymore. But back in the days when I did, all of those meetings, I don't mean the people that funded us. I mean, every time we were pitching a venture fund, whether they said yes or no, the people in the room who actually had a vote, not a single woman across any of those. We probably raised, $100 million across all of those instances, and every one of them involved pitching to six different firms and putting coalitions together. And not once was there a voting female partner in the room. Truly astonishing. Yeah. And again, it's changing, but it's also irrational. Just basic data-driven research on venture capital itself, on female entrepreneurs, on female board members, again and again and again. You see this where there are hurdles. Women are given less money for essentially equivalent startup concepts, and yet actually are more likely to return to their investors. What a paradox that you are given less, forced to work harder, and yet you actually make bigger returns. And yet that lesson never seems to come through in the world. And again, it's so easy to say men and women are different. You can't really know whether everything's the same. And that's where I can offer my life story to say, I don't know. In every way that really mattered, I was more qualified as a female entrepreneur. And yet it was harder and I got less money until I made money. Once I started making money, then suddenly people are hopping on the phone. Hey, what's your next company? I heard you're doing something. Is this something we could invest in? Then everything changes. But before that moment in time, how many people ever get to that second startup? How many people have the chance to build a track record that venture capitalists can be lazy about rather than that first time you worked incredibly hard, just as hard on just as good as idea, but you didn't get the funding, or you didn't get enough funding to build enough runway, and you couldn't create what you wanted to create. You know, often people talk about how women have a different risk profile than men. Men are more risk-philic. And yet, in my own research, and there's a lot of other wonderful research here, we find actually if you control for the fact that men earn more money in salary. So if your startup didn't work as well, you can always go back and get a job, and it will pay more than a woman would earn. That men get bigger funding rounds than women do. That when you take all this stuff into account, men actually don't look much more risk-philic than women do, especially when you think your whole life has been this way, that from the day you were born, you had less at risk than the girls in the classes with you. And then you look at those rare cases where there are matriarchal societies in this world. There's a society in India and another in southwestern China. And in both of those cases, the women are actually pronouncedly more risk-philic than men. In fact, the Indian case, they're like dangerously, they love risk. And the men don't in those societies. And again, it basically boils down to it's because the men have less power, which means every decision for them is more risky.
So, Vivian, I mean, the evidence is so clear now. I mean, you've given so many data points and so many clear numbers. Like, why do you think, I mean, males should also be rational beings and look at the numbers and say, okay, obviously the objective should be to create as much success as possible if they invest in a company, for example. Do you think that we as men, we fear women, or we want to conserve the status of white man privilege? I mean, you were saying that one of the hard decisions for you was to give up the privilege of being a white man. And what would you say were the main privileges that you had to give up? And then please also come back to that first part of the question. Why do you think that is the case? Like, why do you think it is so much harder for you now, like, even though it seems rational to say, okay, let's give women a lot more opportunities?
Yeah, you know, you'd think that people could be rational, at least when there's high stakes, right? If you trained in an elite university, you're managing, let's say, billions of dollars, whether it's a venture fund or mutual fund or whatever it might be, surely you make rational decisions. Maybe humans in some basic sense are irrational, but you have been trained not to. Well, one of my favorite fun little studies of recent years actually looked at investors in Europe and how individual fund managers in Europe change their investment based on national relationships. So let's say we're looking at Norwegian investors, and during that period in time, the general sentiment in Norway was negative about the UK and more positive about France. And what they found was these investors, supposedly making completely independent and rational investment decisions, actually shifted their investments in favor of companies headquartered in France and away from companies headquartered in the UK, even though conceptually there should be no good reason to do it. And you say, well, but maybe Norwegians in general are very rational people. You know, a good longboat and a sword, and you can make a good living, and they're just still being very rational about everything. Well, in this particular case, you can turn it around and you say, well, actually, when we look at Swedes, they have the exact opposite opinion and their investment strategy went in exactly the opposite direction. Well, you both can't be being rational. It turns out in numerous ways, our biases influence our decisions. Mm-hmm. And some of these are truly arbitrary. But some of them, let's be honest, are deep. They're biases that are deeply ingrained into history and culture, and gender bias is one of them. And, you know, there's a number of things I can talk about, one of which is sexual harassment. I actually don't research sexual harassment that much myself, but let's be clear, I am no beauty. I have the great privilege that most people see me as the woman that I am, but I'm approaching 50, and I was never a great looker in my life, and yet I've had people talk to my chest. You know, my own employees stare at my chest while they're talking to me. I am not a risque person. I don't wear low-cut blouses, and yet I have been there. The idea that some simple, let's be very blunt about it, sexual dynamics influence people's choices in a lot of contexts, and where we look at hiring and promotions, when it involves men in power and women out of power, not universally, but quite frequently, a lot of those decisions reflect a man's desire to date a woman as much as anything else, which is profoundly disappointing, I guess, about humanity, but really actually makes you think. You know, I'm running a company. I'm trying to do my best. Let me tell you, if you've never run a company before, it is brutally hard. The one thing I learned early was that I should hire grown-ups and not do it myself, because I am not a grown-up, and get professionals involved as early as you can. But nonetheless, I've been there, and it is hard. And you think, why would I possibly promote someone or not promote them based on something as dumb as I would like to go out with drinks with them later? And yet the research is really clear. That is very much a strong influence on how many people make decisions.
I would like to pick up one point there, because in one of your papers, you're also saying that hiring bias doubles the likelihood of going out of business.
Yeah, so this was a great bit of research that was done, where they looked at, in this case, it was evidence of racial bias in hiring across all of New York City. And they looked, and with some very detailed models, at the nature of hiring, the qualifications of the people being hiring. So they came with a pretty robust. Were they absolutely right on every single hire about whether it was a mistake or not? Surely not. But statistically speaking, they had a strong model of hiring bias. And then they did a comparison. If they took, let's say, the top 25, so the companies with the strongest evidence of bias, versus the bottom 25%, the quartile with the least evidence of bias. And what they found out is, if they came back 5 years later, the companies that had the strongest evidence of bias were vastly more likely to be out of business 5 years later. So again, another example that this isn't just a social justice issue. This is about running a good business. This is about rational decision making, and how these sorts of choices hurt us. And we can extend beyond. So I didn't look at sexual harassment, but what I have looked at is things like gender gap. I it certainly feels to me like I've had to work harder in my life as a woman. I have this experience most pronouncedly in the sciences, which is where I did my transition. So I was a man, and even as an undergrad, I could have spoken up in a room and everyone would listen. And boy, is that a heady thing. You know, when the professors stop and listen to you and take you seriously, I like to call that the voice. Having that voice was powerful. And, now it is harder. I remember one woman, a professor at Stanford, who went through transition, and she talked about how the first time she felt truly accepted as a woman in science was the time that she stood up at a conference and made a point in response to a presentation, and essentially got no response. And then 5 minutes later, a man stood up and made the exact same point and got applause. And she felt, yes, finally, they accept that I am a woman, because of course I'm being treated terribly. As she also shared that it only took two or three more times before she was totally sick of it. And I have, you know, the mansplaining, that is maybe my number one thing that, every other hardship I can deal with. I can't do as many push-ups, and people assume I don't know science and technology as well as I actually do. All of that is annoying, But the mansplaining, oh my goodness, that is the frequency with which I want to punch some fat middle-aged guy in the face because he's explaining my own research to me. It is astonishing. It is, men, oh my, you have no idea how annoying you can occasionally be. And it's not all of you. There are definitely some villains in this story. But then, you know, we have done this research where we've been able to look at why it is that women behave differently. So you're trying to look for this understanding about why is there still bias in the system. And I think, you know, the way I look at it, and maybe it comes from my background, again, as a scientist, as a neuroscientist in particular, is I take a very systems view of it. And you have to understand that women are growing up in a system which holds them back, in which women's status is almost by default less than men. And this is different country to country. It's different culture to culture. But there is no country in which this disappears. There is no country in which there is not a wage gap, for example. Mm. And so you grow up knowing you will likely earn less than men doing the same work as you. Even if I don't mean literally that fact is on your mind, the broad idea is there. It's the background. The hero of every movie you watch, or at least 99% of them, is a man. The heroes of our history are 99% men and white men at that. And it tells you a strong story that your hard work and your life might be valuable to you, but it just isn't going to pay off in the same way it will for your brother. And so, you know, if you knew that all of this effort you were putting into your education and all of this effort you were putting into your career would pay off a little bit less than it will for your peers, then it is in fact entirely rational for you to work a little bit less, not throughout your whole life, but in that specific instance. Maybe I don't work that extra hour in the evening. Maybe I don't put in a few hours in the weekend finishing up a report. Instead, I put it towards my family or my church, or I put it towards a philanthropic initiative I want to. In those sorts of things, women's lives pay off the same as men, sometimes more. Yeah. So now we stack the deck. Women have a good reason to invest in other parts of their lives, whereas men have a good reason to invest in their careers. And then we live in the results of that dynamic.
I love how you were also saying that in the context of learning, when you talk about the future of learning, and you were saying that one of the key motivators for learners is to trust that their hard work will pay off. And if they can't trust in that, then they won't learn as effectively and won't put the motivation and the effort in to learn very, very, or put in the hard work that is required to get the results that you want. One thing that would really interest me, Vivian, is have you ever, I mean, you've debated with so many people, and I loved how you were saying or were talking about your conversations you had with Ray Kurzweil and with Malcolm Gladwell and Sir Ken Robinson. Have you ever had a conversation or a debate with Jordan Peterson?
I have not. I would certainly always be up for this sort of thing. I am someone who's really interested in finding consensus. And there are things that Jordan Peterson and I would surely agree upon. And so whenever I'm with someone, what I'm trying to find is where we agree and how we can build on something from there. I've got to say there is, and this is a place where someone like Jordan Peterson has flourished, and as well as some others, social media culture has produced a phenomenally combative society. This is certainly true in the United States, but I feel like this has become a worldwide phenomenon where the purpose of social interaction is to win. To beat the other person in an argument. Obviously, I'm right about everything, always. So I won before I even walked in the room. But what value is that? Yeah. He already believes that he's right. I already believe that I'm right. We are both intelligent people that have good arguments for the things we believe. In the end, the thing we might actually be able to create is the thing we're willing to create together. I would be transparent. There are people with which I would have zero interest in having such a conversation. I don't care if Donald Trump and I agree on anything. And it turns out there are some things, some policies, some very rare ones, but some policies I support. Doesn't mean I would want to have anything to do with him or the White House. I am not a particularly big supporter of the military, but when NATO asked if I could come and give them a briefing on my research, I was there. When the Pentagon, or the CIA asked for briefings on my research, I went. I told them the truth. I didn't sugarcoat anything, but if there's something I could say that would change how they would act, of course I would love to have that conversation. Yeah. And I've done that for the boards of many companies that I deeply disagree with. But again, the idea is there something I could say, one thing that they could walk away with that would actually change how they work? The last thing I need to do is preach to the choir, to tell people that already believe that diversity is a value in society one more time that they're right. Instead, what I want to do is think, what are the things we could actually do collectively that would make a difference? And there are very concrete things, except they don't happen if you can't find some degree of consensus.
Yeah. Well, since I really love listening to you and to Jordan Peterson, because I think that you both have great arguments, maybe hopefully when Jordan Peterson is better, maybe I can set that up. And I mean, you're coming to our conference next year, and maybe there's a chance that we can bring him in as well and have a conversation between the two of you.
I would love that. I will say it's not that I have no ego whatsoever. The single compliment I will treasure for the entire rest of my life is after this big conference where I was on the doing a keynote panel along with Ray Kurzweil, where halfway through he put his hand over the mic, leaned over to me, and said with some real exasperation, "Who the hell are you?"
Yeah, I told that story.
I was so thrilled. But this is the thing, you have to hold that back. The purpose of my work is not to win points. Every year, life is very, very good to me, financially and other ways. And so we give it all away. Last year, I earned about $1 million and I kept about 70,000. And every other dollar went towards the initiatives at Socos Labs that we think will make a difference in people's lives, tracking the economic impact of high growth entrepreneurs from unusual and different backgrounds, building a system to treat diabetes, building a new technology to understand suicide risk across populations. We hopefully will be able to launch an initiative with UNICEF to track adolescent mental health around the world. Those are the things that I care about. Mm-hmm. And, I could certainly live a very different life if I kept all that money. We could write some nice books. I could go on the speaker circuit and do some debates. It would be very comfortable. And everything that is good about my life would go away. I have to do these things. Because I truly believe that they are the right thing to do. And in the end, that means if I'm willing to talk to someone at all, what I'm willing to talk to them about is how could we collaborate to do something better?
I find it fascinating how you were saying in your story in the beginning already that once you stop focusing on success and all these external factors so much, they started to appear more. And that's the thing that I've heard many times. And I think that is also why it's so important that we have people like you in this world who just focus on the work that they're doing and the value that they can create for others. I've got two more questions about...
Let me be a little bit honest about that, because sometimes it's terrifying. You don't think it's terrifying giving away all that money? I don't mean it goes into a trust. I mean, by the end of the year, we have put it towards the projects we believe in. I could have put it in a trust fund for my kids. I could have bought a big house somewhere. I'm not saying this to be pat myself on the back. I'm saying the admission, it is terrifying. Every year I'm thinking, I'm going to be old someday. Am I going to look back and think of what a fool I was to not have that taking care of me, to not have invested all of that money in my children, except I believe fundamentally that my kids are going to grow up in a better world in which they will have more chances and opportunities. Because instead of spending it on them, instead of spending it on trips and fancy clothes, we spent it on the world I wanted my kids to grow up in. Mm. It will still be an imperfect world, but this is the single best, most selfish thing I could do with all of this. But I never want it to come across like this is an easy decision. Yeah. It is a terrifying decision. And it took essentially, I got a little bit of freedom that ruining my life, ending up homeless, really gave me some perspective. Every good thing in my life at this point is a gift. And so I don't feel like I'm risking anything, but it's still hard. And I don't want to dismiss in any way how hard these decisions can be for other people, only that this is the only good decision I can find.
I want to ask one more question on this topic, and then I would like to take a few more minutes to talk about the current crisis that we're facing. And I mean, you're based in the Bay Area, and you were mentioning in your research that the scale of female entrepreneurship is growing there, but you were still saying that female founders in San Francisco could have created more than 4 million additional jobs over the last 20 years if some barriers were removed. And could you share what barriers do you think should be removed, and how could that be done?
Yeah, so we built this tool. We call it the Inclusion Impact Index. And we pulled data from so many different sites, just this massive data. We're specifically focused on the US right now. Our goal is to take this around the world. But what it is a real-time economic index, metro by metro in the United States. There are about 90 metros that we currently track that have at least 50 funded high-growth entrepreneurs in them. So we have data on 120,000 people that over the last 20 years have built companies in high-growth entrepreneurship. Think Google and Facebook. Facebook, having been founded in the last 20 years, is in our data set, as is every other big company you can imagine based in the United States. And what we are able to show now is how many jobs were created by high-growth entrepreneurs in Atlanta, how many patents were generated by female entrepreneurs in Seattle, how much funding was brought in by LGBT plus entrepreneurs, queer entrepreneurs in New York City. So we can answer all these questions effectively in real time. Now, real time for this kind of data is about month to month, but we get this in and you can see all of this information about patent creation, job creation, funding, exits, and the drivers of them. So we're able to analyze and build these what are called counterfactual economic models that say, you know what, forget a perfect world. If we simply imagined that female entrepreneurs in San Francisco, given the industries that they work in, could create as many jobs as the female entrepreneurs in the best performing US metros, then what would that look like? And what are the barriers to that happening? And what it looks like is what you already said. Over the last 20 years, we estimate that women would have created an additional 4 million jobs in San Francisco, not simply assuming they performed equally well with men, but simply saying, you know, there turns out there are some other cities and cities that might surprise people, like Houston, or Minneapolis or Cleveland, like cities that do not appear even in the US consciousness of entrepreneurship, much less internationally. And yet women in those cities have been astonishingly successful, at least on average. And so then we say, well, imagine you've been able to achieve those same kinds of outcomes at scale in San Francisco. And so what we find is San Francisco is far and away, for almost every population, the US center and really the world center of high growth entrepreneurship. So the majority of female entrepreneurs, or at least the plurality of them, are based in San Francisco. It is the biggest economic engine for female entrepreneurs in the world. However, when you look at their performance on average, it's pretty mediocre. They are getting significantly less, not just than men, significantly less than the best performing cities matched algorithmically. And so we call this the difference between our actual counted numbers and our achievable numbers, what we believe female entrepreneurs could achieve, even granting they don't go into entrepreneurship at the same rates as men, even granting that some barriers seem to be very persistent and hard to overcome, and we can't magically make them go away. And one of the things we note, for example, another city that's terrible for female entrepreneurship is Los Angeles. It has a large number of female entrepreneurs, but on average, really struggling. And one of the things we note is entertainment. You know, LA is famously an industry town. It is very driven by a couple of core industries like entertainment. And entertainment, it turns out to be very bad for women. Low funding rates, low access to capital, just poor outcomes in general. Well, given everything we know now about the Me Too movement, are we really that shocked that entertainment is such a terrible industry for female entrepreneurs? We see similar things in many industries. In fact, a lot of the core ones in San Francisco, whereas we're also able to identify others, biotech, artificial intelligence, very sophisticated industries, and surprisingly, some others like energy, where women really have shined. And so the whole point of putting the index together is not simply to say this city is doing better than that city. We can already kind of assume which cities might look good on an inclusion impact index and which might not. Instead was, hey, are you the mayor of Indianapolis, a US city which is not notable for its rate of inclusion? What could you do to create more jobs for your citizens that just happen to be created by women? They happen to be created by people that are gay. They happen to be created by someone who's Black or is a refugee or what have you. So we're expanding already to include racial minorities in the United States, to look at things like refugee status or what are called dreamers, people that came to the US as undocumented children, but are now, they're Americans, and yet there are many in the U.S. that want them to go to a home that they've never been to. And to actually track, did you know how many jobs these people, your niece has a job because someone a little bit different than you created something special. Your mother has a cure because someone a little different than you created a company that developed that cure. To be able to, one, tell those stories, but even more meaningfully, tell policymakers, and again, we want to take this worldwide, tell policymakers, here is the thing you can do to reinvent your city so that when you are faced with a Syrian refugee crisis, when you're looking at how to overcome gender wage gaps, when you're thinking about, you know, the integration of, ethnic Turks in Germany or indigenous First Nations people in Canada or Malay people in Singapore, this is what has been successful, to be able to share actual actions that would make a difference rather than just wag a finger at people and tell them that they're bad.
I would like to pick up the topic of the current crisis of COVID-19 just for a few more minutes, because You are one of the world leading AI experts, and you've also looked at a lot of numbers when it comes to that situation, and you also wrote a paper about it. And obviously, if we do nothing about this whole situation right now, it threatens to kill millions of people. But one thing that I find interesting about your perspective is that you were saying that our current response may easily do the same, and we have this fork problem at the moment where we have to look at, okay, what kind of decision are we making and how can we act? And you're talking about, you're saying it's a trolley problem and that we need to build a new track and otherwise both lead to disaster. And you were saying that you don't want to have anything to do with the White House, and I understand that. But if I were to ask you now, if you were to be the president, how would you tackle the crisis, or how would you have tackled it? What measures would you have, or policies would you have implemented with all the research that you've done, where you feel, okay, you could have constrained it a bit more? Because you were saying that the way that the current presidency has dealt with it, it costs trillions of dollars. And you were saying that even with this minor cut of that, obviously there must have been some measures of preventing the situation that you have in America now.
Yeah. So, let's be honest. While America has had one of the most incompetent responses to COVID-19, it has been a global struggle. And even those countries that have responded well, it is still a real challenge moving forward. And let's also be very clear. The general nature of this debate is, let's do nothing, just pretend like there's nothing wrong. As a result, millions of people globally will die. Or let's do everything, which is to say complete lockdown and nobody can do anything. And there were moments in time where things were very scary, and that latter made a lot of sense. But particularly in the United States, it seems to be that's the debate. And then we go from lockdown to we'll make one allowance at a time. We'll pick one thing which will open up, which astonishingly in the States has been things like, instead of opening schools, we're going to open bars and nightclubs. Instead of quarantining elder care facilities, we're going to let the National Basketball Association quarantine their players and allow games to be broadcast. Mm. And I look at that and I think this is crazy. Our admittedly very back of the napkin estimates is that just based on past recessions and depressions, we know that people entering job markets, for example, during major economic shocks, don't just have worse job outcomes, they have dramatically worse life outcomes, including fundamental things like all-cause mortality. The last great job shock globally was the 81-82 recession. It's been heavily studied in the UK and the US. Jobless rates went up to about 10%. And people that lost their jobs during that recession had a dramatic 8-point increase in their likelihood of dying within the next 20 to 30 years. So when I talk about this being a trolley problem, what I mean is, we are staring at potentially, if we do nothing, millions of people dying globally on one side, possibly more than a million dying in the US alone. And yet, if we sacrifice, and I don't like to think of it as the economy because it makes people think of dollars and euros, but if we sacrifice the capacity of our countries to support ourselves, we will kill people on the other side as well. It won't happen tomorrow, but it will happen. And so how do we come up with a rational strategy to deal with both of those? And I'm far from the only person that has said, one thing we need to do is understand that different people need different things. Right now, it is insane to me that every elder care facility, every hospital, all of these should be fully quarantined, and they should have been from day one. In the industrialized world, 50 to 70% of all deaths have been in elder care. And the equivalent of the elderly living at home, say, for example, in some parts of Italy, has also occurred. We should take all those empty hospitals and create places that are fully quarantined. Another recent discovery, a paper just was written. It turned out in the US, we pay our elder care workers so little that they can't do one job. So they work at multiple care facilities. Well, guess what? Rather than the number of past health violations, it is the number of people working at multiple care facilities that predicts spread of COVID-19 in these facilities. No. So let's pay these people 10 times what they currently earn. But they also have to stay there. Instead of sending the NBA to Disneyland so that they can play their basketball games in safety, and they still sneak out and go to strip clubs, why don't we pay these people like they're going to war? And they stay in these facilities. We got all these unused hospitals. And you think this is crazy. It would be so expensive. The US has lost $13 trillion from its economy already. It wouldn't even come, it wouldn't be $1 trillion in expense to do anything I'm talking about right now. Another thing that we actually model out using artificial intelligence is predictive modeling of likely super spreaders. And this is not just people, but also places. And it is very, I'm not saying it's easy, but it is very doable to analyze social graph data and mobility data and identify people before they become a cause of a spread. Identify people that are likely to be super spreaders. And again, just pay them to stay home. You know, this could be very carrot and stick. It does not have to be a big brother telling everyone what to do. So much as it is, listen, for a little while, we need to be a little bit more community oriented and we will handsomely compensate you. Because what do we care if it cost us, $100,000? If we actually basically had to pay someone a salary to go hang out in a hotel for a little while, that's going to be so much less than $15 trillion. That those two things alone. Just creating those quarantine zones and identifying super spreaders ahead of time. Some modeling done, for example, by a group of economists at MIT suggests that that's what's called heterogeneous intervention models suggest we would have our R-naught, which is roughly our replication rate, well below one, down to like 0.3, which means COVID slowly goes away. And it would cost two orders of magnitude less than our current strategy. So I just look at those, and it isn't a question of dollars versus lives. It is what do we do rationally to save as many lives as possible in the long run, now and into the future. And I don't see that kind of decision making going on almost anywhere. Some places are a little better. I'm very impressed with Taiwan's approach, but I don't think anyone has fully invested in that kind of very honest policymaking.
I find it very important that you're mentioning this long-term perspective point, especially looking at areas of the world where I've spent a lot of time in Africa, for example. I think in one of your papers, you also quoting or giving an example of a recent estimate from South Africa suggesting that the poverty resulting from the lockdown, from the current lockdown, and I've got lots of friends over there, and it's a crazy situation. The current response will lead to 29 long-term deaths for every life saved today. And I mean, it's such a tough decision to say, okay, how can we deal with this situation? And one of the things that you were saying that could help, and that is the last thing that I want to talk to you about, is how can technology help? And you were saying that, I mean, when this whole thing started, I think a lot of AI enthusiasts got really excited about maybe using AI to solve this. And you were saying that you're using it to identify super spreaders. Then, of course, it's also an interesting question, okay, like how private should data be in that whole debate, and like should they be able to track all your movement? But what do you see the most promising technologies to be to help solve this crisis?
I mean, one thing to understand is, I hope it doesn't shock everyone, they're already tracking all of your movements. This isn't really conspiracy theory talk. I just mean, certainly in the United States, your cell phone company knows everywhere you've been. Apple, Google, depending on which kind of phone you have, they know everywhere you've been. So the question isn't, does someone have this information, but are we using this information in a responsible way? And I think protections for privacy, protections against abuse, governance and oversight, nothing good happens here unless we address those and address them. We don't just say, you know, we'll figure that out after, but right now we're going to save lives. Nope. We need to make those priorities as well, because that's part of the long-term outcome. Is you can't deprioritize anything in this discussion. Having said that, and a lot of the talk about AI is really focused on things like diagnostics. You know, one of the coolest versions of this I heard of, which has yet to be proven, but I still love the concept, having worked with sound myself in the past, is an app that listens to your breathing sounds and makes a prediction about whether you're experiencing pneumonia conditions, whether this is COVID. And there are other interesting behavioral biomarkers that could be very predictive. And I think all of that is exciting, but may not be ready until, let's just say, the next time, because there's going to be a next time. Right now, the things that in fact are fairly mature technologies have to do a lot with network analysis. So as I talked about, using mobility and social network data to predict likely people and sites of spread and proactively go and intervene on them. And this is something that's been done outside of COVID-19, using similar sorts of techniques to improve the use of prophylactic interventions in the spread of, for example, parasitic worms in Africa. You find the person who, you know, if you could intervene on them, they would break the chain of transmission the best. And it works. This sort of thing works. And interestingly, even spaces outside of COVID as a disease, there's been an enormous amount of work. For example, analyzing new scientific research, building deep neural networks to analyze initial research papers before they've been reviewed, with the hopes of surfacing the ones that are, one, most likely to pan out and be true, and you know, find commonalities among them for additional research. We're moving so fast right now, trying to find treatments, trying to find symptoms, what's real and what isn't, even among the scientific community, is hard. And there have been some groups out there, and we've had our chance to contribute, that are actually using AI to speed up that process, to, in essence, pre-process science to look for the trends that might be most promising. And another domain is disinformation. There have been some really great tests out there of some existing systems to identify and essentially target lies online. You know, this is an amazing treatment, and we know it isn't. And unfortunately, the fucking president of the United States is claiming that he's taking it. He almost certainly is not, because he's not, he's dumb, but not in that way. And so we look at those sorts of things, and we can see, you know, you can see it as it emerges. And it turns out there's like a sweet period where you can intervene in these discussions and in essence, rescue, forgive me being wonky in my language, rescue the discursive value, the value of that conversation, by intervening and giving some truth into those conversations. And I've been really excited at people. So all of these different areas, diagnostics, the pre-processing of scientific research, the intervention against lies. And yes, I'm a little proud of the work we've done in predictive intervention. All of these, I think, are pieces. But really, the thing I always say about artificial intelligence is, if you want to know if you have a good idea, would it work if you didn't have the AI? You know, imagine you have a giant budget instead. You know, mm-hmm. Could you hire a whole bunch of people and implement that idea? Are you imagining that there's a point in your strategy where essentially someone waves a magic wand, and that magic wand just happens to be AI, and it fixes all your problems? If that is your plan, it will not work. I guarantee it. Only if you know a true strategy, what AI can do is change the economics of that strategy. And it is as true of COVID-19 as it is of everything else.
Vivian, I want to thank you for being so open and intimate in this conversation and sharing so many personal details and sharing so many valuable insights as well on the diversity topic, on this conversation now on the COVID-19 crisis. Unfortunately, there were a few topics we did manage to touch upon, but I'm sure we'll get the chance soon again. And I send all my best regards to San Francisco and thank you so much for this conversation.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure. I look forward to chatting again.